here is that there was, that the injustices that were occurring and the displacement that was occurring was not based on notions that the Indians were inferior and were not based on a lack of understanding of what justice required. That was stated clearly by, in official documents, repeatedly. Also, when the Indian chiefs spoke in meetings, it was clear that they had very impressive and eloquent statements of what the situation was and what justice required, and the statements were of such a nature that no one could have missed that these were people of equal ability and equal claims to all the characteristics of humanity. So I think that raises this question. First of all, in response to Hugh Brody's question, what is the force of principles of justice? Are they merely pieties and platitudes, or do they have some real influence over human events? I think the fact that those statements are made repeatedly in official documents and that we come now trying to grapple with these problems and that they keep coming up over and over again. What are the rights on one side and another? Shows that we cannot ignore these things, especially in a nation dedicated to the principles of liberty, equality, and justice. There is a nagging persistence that we must find a way to make our behavior accord with the principles, even though we know, as human beings, that there will be some difference between what we do and what we say and what we believe in. But that those statements of justice and those are not, they may be in the mouths of some scoundrels, simply platitudes and deceptions, but that they have a force that cannot be ignored and that comes back persistently and influences what we are willing to do and what we try to do, I think is indisputable. The difficulty is that with the best of motives, things often turn out badly, especially legislation. Most legislation fails to accomplish its objectives, and it's very common that carefully designed legislation accomplishes exactly the opposite of the intention. There's a long list of legislation. I lived in England the year that they tried to stop the outflow of sterling currency by putting a limitation on how much any British citizen could take out of the country for on a business trip or on a vacation. The result that year was a record amount of sterling was carried out of the country legally, just because the legislation had loopholes and everybody had an incentive to find those loopholes. We had legislation year after year when there was a farm surplus, trying to reduce the farm surplus. Every year, without fail, it increased the farm surplus. And there's a long list. ANCSA is not the only piece of legislation. If it worked the way it had been intended, it would be an exception. The fact that it's working, not working successfully, and perhaps working to the contrary effect of it, of the expectations, is the norm in legislation, and it's unnecessary to bring in theories of conspiracy or bad motives to explain what has happened. The two questions I raise is, first of all, that we think about the force of the principles of justice in Western behavior. The other is, what is this other force that moves, despite the pronouncements, what is this other force that moves settlers, that moves populations, that changes things despite the legislation? The restrictions on settlers in the Northwest Ordinance and in legislation that followed from it had no effect whatsoever. The settlers were coming over from Kentucky, crossing the mountains. Wherever they found this rich farmland, there were also some Indians. They quickly made a deal with whatever Indians were there, signed a formal agreement, paid them some money, and began to farm. Well, it turned out that those Indians were not local. They were constantly roving, and there was a lot of rivalry, even hostility, among the Indian groups and tribes in that region. And so they would sell somebody else's land without the slightest hesitation, take the money, and go on their way. Then the real occupants of that territory would see settlers, contrary to the arrangements that had been made and the solemn treaties that had been made, and of course they would try to drive them out. Then the settlers would defend themselves because they had made what they thought was a valid agreement and paid them whatever had to be paid to be there, and now they thought these Indians were going back on the agreement. In short, if you take a situation of a vast territory, people who don't understand each other, the movement toward agriculture and development, all the possibilities for misunderstanding and bad communications, you don't have to have bad motives to get a result that is very different from what the legislators had hoped for. Now, that force, I think, that has that we characterize as, though people speak of Western values and Western ideology and other such things, I think it can be stated with a little bit more clarity and substance. It's the doctrine of growth or increase. That is, it's the opposite of subsistence. It's an unwillingness to live with what nature alone provides. And when people who live by the doctrine of growth as a way of life, who insist on trying to increase the little bit that nature provides, when people of the growth society come into association with people of a subsistence way of life, the outcome is not controllable, unfortunately, by legislation. It's like trying to legislate that the tides will not come in. And that force is something that we ought to talk about. The notion of growth, or the oldest formulation of it from 300 years ago in John Locke, the idea of increase, has transformed the world. It hasn't affected only native peoples, but any people who have tried to stand in the way. Peoples of the same religion, nationality, language, and culture, but of the sort who were not engaged in activities of increase, have been overwhelmed by it, dispossessed, and you know, the great movement of people from agriculture into urban life. That's just this tide of the results of the idea of increase. One last point. On the question of the special place, the special status of the native peoples, I agree that it's a very different matter from the immigrant groups of Americans. Accommodation means assimilation to a very large extent for all of the immigrant groups, and I think there's been no exception. Now, there can be some, it isn't so that Polish Americans are completely assimilated. In Chicago, one hears young children who may be third and fourth generation Americans now still speaking Polish as the language at home. And elements of the way of life that is distinctive, that keeps them distinctive and separate, can be found. But of course, there's been a tremendous mixing too, so that some people can't tell now what they are because they've been intermarriage of Polish Americans and Irish Americans and Italian Americans. But the distinctive thing about the Native Americans is that their ethnic difference is linked to the land. I'm Jewish myself, and Jews are certainly a separate and distinct people and with a long record of survival under the most adverse conditions imaginable. But the survival of the Jews is in part explained by the fact that they're not people of a particular land, but they're people of a book. And the book was portable, so that wherever they went, they were Jews. There is a great danger to Jewishness in assimilation, and the number of people who are really Jewish is greatly diminishing in the United States. In addition, now because of the establishment of the nation of Israel, there is a complication, and Jews are somehow connected with a land, and that may be another danger. But it's very hard to figure out what the place should be in the United States under the peculiarities of the United States Constitution and the United States law for people who are connected with a particular place. And I think that's the significant claim for Native Alaskans for some special status. That would justify a special status, even though there are so many other kinds of hyphenated Americans who would say, well, why should they have a special status if we don't? Because there is no special land attachment for Vietnamese Americans or Polish Americans in the United States, and there is for Native Alaskans. So if there's any basis for a special status, I think it's that connection with the land. How to carry it on from there, I don't know, but I'll stop.
Well, thank you, Mr. Goldman. That was very, very helpful. I thought that what we might do, if you don't mind, is this might be an appropriate time in just a moment to adjourn for lunch, and then we might ask Sandy Davis this afternoon to pick up the discussion by telling us how these principles of justice affirmed by Las Casas 400 years ago and found in Spanish law and not to mention the Northwest Ordinance, how are they exemplified on the ground in Latin America? What's actually happening there? Then I thought we might, there's been a surfeit of very provocative ideas that have been raised this morning, and they're all worthwhile, and I hope we will reach them all in some order, but subject to what David and Rosita may say, maybe we could start out with Sandy this afternoon, and perhaps we might also hear sometime this afternoon from Moses Kaela, who comes from Hawaii, because there the Native people had the opportunity of seeing U.S. Principles of justice in play even before they were a part of the U.S., and that might offer us a particular vantage point in that connection. And as well, Hawaii is a place where there has been an enormous amount of immigration, and that bears on the point that Professor Hanke raised and Professor Hsu raised. So I think that if it's all right with everybody, we might adjourn until 1:30 and start again with Sandy Davis. If you had had any thoughts about the way we're proceeding, I take it. Well, I thought that we might begin this afternoon. By asking Sandy Davis to talk about the state of affairs in Latin America and South America. How well have those principles for which Las Casas struggled been reflected in recent practice in terms of the acknowledgement of the rights of the indigenous peoples of Latin America and South America, and any other reflections that Sandy might care to offer. And then perhaps we could discuss that with Sandy and then move on to Moses Keala from Hawaii. So go ahead, Sandy.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to make a little mention here before I begin. Charlie Edwardson passed on to me a copy of something which I don't understand at all, which needs some of the legal minds here to interpret. But there's part of the U.S. Code that is numbered 1492. It's U.S. Code. Now, there's some symbolism in that. And as I understand it, this section of the code has to do with submitting a report to Congress by anyone who is a citizen, I take it, that would then be part of a legislative discussion in Congress. At some point, I think Charlie may want to discuss this with us. And for the symbolism alone, I think we should give that some consideration. So at some time, either this afternoon, I think, or maybe during the session, we may want to discuss this. But I was asked to give a brief overview of the situation of Native peoples in South and Central America. I am going to try to be very brief and pretty extemporaneous, too. I think the first thing that has to be said, it's really a misnomer to talk about Latin America. It's truly a misnomer. I think we can more talk about Indian America than Latin America in a certain sense, because the presence of Indian people, especially south of the Rio Grande in South and Central America, is so great and so dominant, both physically and demographically and culturally, that to speak of Latin America is more of a wish fulfillment about what the continent should be like than really what its reality is. I just came back from Bolivia, where I was 3 weeks ago, and anyone who visits La Paz in Bolivia, which is the capital of Bolivia, has some idea of how the indigenous presence, its existence. When I rode in from the airport in the largest capital probably in the Americas, the highest capital of any country in the Americas, when I drove in from the airport, on the radio, the taxi driver changed from one station where they were giving the news in Aymara, and to the second station where the news was being given in Quechua, and then turned to another station where the news was being given in Spanish, but he really couldn't understand the station that was on Spanish, so he went back to the presentation of the news in Aymara, which are the two major languages, Aymara and Quechua. In La Paz itself is essentially a city that's made up of native people, a large city of several hundred thousand people. It's made up of native people. Not only do people speak the native languages, but the clothing that they wear are of native design and native production. The music that is heard is native music. The food that is eaten is native food. The houses that are constructed in even the slum areas of the city have a certain resemblance to native household design in the rural areas. The only problem is the control of the state isn't in the hands of the native people of Bolivia, but is in the hands of the people of Spanish descendants. But it's essentially an Indian country. And I think the thing that could be said is that the native presence in South and Central America is dominant in many areas. That's true statistically as well. I usually don't believe the official statistics on the number of indigenous populations, and there's no reason usually to believe them, but even the official statistics that exist on the native populations of South and Central America indicate a significant rise in population over the past two or three decades. The official statistics of the number of Indians, the number of people that speak indigenous languages and who identify with Indian communities are that in 1960, there were classified 14 million indigenous people in South and Central America. By 1978, that figure had risen to over 30 million people, more than doubled, according to the official statistics. One figure has it that there's more than 400 surviving indigenous groups with their own languages and cultures and forms of identity, over 400 different indigenous ethnic groups in South and Central America. If you include the number of indigenous ethnic groups in North America with that, probably numbers near 400 or 500 different indigenous ethnic groups in the Americas. So the Western Hemisphere is an indigenous hemisphere to this day. There's an incredible diversity amongst that population, an enormous diversity, but perhaps the most striking thing about within that diversity is the struggle for survival, both especially the struggle for cultural survival of those groups that is a dominant aspect of the situation of those people in South and Central America. I'd like to mention three areas within the diversity, at least to mention three areas of that struggle for survival, for cultural survival of indigenous groups. Sometimes it's a struggle for physical survival as well, and I'll mention that as well. In three areas, which will give some idea of the diversity of problems that these groups of people face. And I think in all three of those areas, there's some implications for what's going on here in Alaska. At least I'll suggest them that may be a point of discussion. I think if we want to look at the great diversity in South and Central America, one place to look is in the lowlands of South America, especially in the area of that forms part of what's known as the Amazon Basin. The riverine system that cuts across about a third of South America, which is made up not only of the Amazon River, but of more than 25 different tributaries of the Amazon, and covers seven or eight different South American countries, the largest being Brazil, where more than half of Brazil is made up of Amazonian ecology, but also large parts of Venezuela, of Ecuador, of Bolivia, Peru, of Colombia, Suriname. these lowland areas. These were areas where there were an enormous number of indigenous groups, well, probably hundreds of different indigenous groups, relatively small in number. Each indigenous group might have been 500 persons or 1,000 persons. At the upper limit, probably 2,500 or 5,000 persons along the Amazon River itself in some areas. But mainly, they were very small societies, small nations. The two probably most characteristic features of those societies were, one, an enormous least sophisticated adaptation to the ecology of the Amazon. The Amazon ecology is unique in the sense that it's a tropical rainforest area where the soils are not very productive for agriculture and where dependence for survival must be based on the production of the natural flora and fauna and fish of the Amazon itself, rather than on an intensive system of agricultural production. All of the studies that have been done by anthropologists or environmental scientists indicate that there was an enormously sophisticated environmental and cultural adaptation to the Amazonian rainforest, including control of population size, various customs that were by the people themselves. The other aspect was an enormously complex and sophisticated cosmology or worldview. There's been, perhaps the most well-known studies are by the French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, who has spent all of his life writing about the cosmologies of South American indigenous people. Their philosophies, their systems of classification, their knowledge of the environment, their ideas of astronomy, of wildlife, of natural environments, and of their general worldviews are of such complex order and of such variability that it's only, in some sense, relatively recently that people have recognized the complexity of those cosmologies amongst native indigenous peoples of South America. The important thing, though, from the viewpoint of the current situation of those people is that since the Spanish and the Portuguese, there's been an attempt to enter into the tropical lowlands of South America in order to exploit its natural potential and natural wealth for the profit of European powers or of the nation states in South America. This took place in the 16th century, where there was the search by the Portuguese and the Spanish for the city of El Dorado, which nobody was sure was whether it was in Ecuador or Brazil or which part of the Amazon. It took place in the 19th and early 20th century, where the rubber boom encompassed the Amazon region and where the whole production of natural rubber took place in that area, with drastic effects of dislocating and uprooting indigenous societies. But the real, quote, opening up of the Amazon has taken place since the end of the Second World War, and especially in the decade of the 1960s and 1970s. There's been massive highway development in the Amazon, petroleum and mineral exploration, colonization by large-scale cattle ranchers and by settlers, and an enormous development of hydroelectric potential in the area, in a systematic and persistent opening up of the Amazon as, again, quote, the last frontier of South America. Great expansion of Western industrial society into the lowland regions has created a massive conflict between the remaining indigenous societies of the lowlands, of the Amazonian lowlands, and the expanding Western frontier. That conflict has had three aspects of it, two of which at least are consistent with what's known here in Alaska. One, it's created an enormous conflict between the rights to subsistence and the rights to extract the mineral and agricultural and hydroelectric and other resources of the region. An enormous conflict has taken place between state institutions and private institutions that want to develop those regions for profit and the indigenous groups that need to subsist in those regions by its on its natural products. The other aspect of that is a land claim struggle. Most of the laws, at least until the late 1960s, early 1970s, there was very little national legislation protecting the land rights of indigenous people in those areas. At present, there's a body of law in almost all of the indigenous countries that, at least in terms of the law, recognizes in some of Indian land rights, although not a single country in South America recognizes the right of indigenous people to either subsoil wealth, to water rights, or to forestry resources. But there are some land rights that are recognized. But yet, despite these recognition in terms of the law, they're systematically abrogated in practice. So in almost every country of South America, indigenous people who are struggling before the courts or before state agencies to get rights to land find that when their rights come in conflict with outside institutions, they're usually the losers. Now, in the case of South America, there's a further aspect of that subsistence struggle and the land rights struggle that has to be looked at, and that has to do with the right to life. Because in many of these areas where Indian lands are coveted by either the state or private interests, Indians are slaughtered on those lands in order to get use of those resources. That's taken place in the 1960s in Brazil, when Indians were given blankets with smallpox, when Indians were massacred and shot. It's happened in Colombia in the late 1960s and early 1970s, when the army was sent in to put down resistance by Indians against colonists. It's happened in Paraguay with the case of the Aché Indians, who were systematically hunted down by government agents in order to bring them on reserves so they wouldn't continue to hunt in the forests of eastern Paraguay. And there's still incidents that reach human rights organizations and indigenous organizations about serious right-to-life issues of lowland South American Indians. So in defending themselves, these lowland South American Indian groups, against the expansion of the Western industrial frontier into the tropical lowlands, they're faced not only with the protection of their land and resources, but also with the serious possibility of being systematically massacred and exterminated in the process of defending their land rights. The one hopeful sign are federations. Throughout the Amazonian lowlands at present, there's indigenous federations that have sprouted up in the 1960s and 1970s, and by the 1980s are beginning to organize across national boundaries. So now the indigenous federation in Peru is meeting with the indigenous federations of Ecuador, Bolivia, Brazil, in trying to get a united front amongst lowland Amazonian Indians to defend their land rights and their cultural rights in front of the state or international development agencies or multinational companies. And there's a very strong movement of indigenous federations in the lowland of South America. So that's all one situation there, where at least the subsistence development conflict, which is so characteristic here of Alaska, is being acted out. One time I wrote an article called The Amazon Basin, the Alaska of South America, and it was about this struggle that's going on. There's a second area that is important to see the differences and the similarity, and where another sort of problem is going on. That's in the Andean countries. The Andean countries are highland areas, mainly in Colombia, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Peru. There are areas where the large Andean mountain chain, which forms the Cordillera or mountain chain that goes from north to south along the central and western edge of South America, where there's the descendants, essentially, although there's other indigenous groups there, of the great Inca civilization that began in Peru, what is today Peru, and spread out to include Incaic speaking peoples and Inca peoples in Ecuador and Bolivia and parts of Colombia as well. These are highland indigenous groups. They're not lowland indigenous groups. They're groups that were very influenced by the Spanish invasion in the 16th century, which were reorganized into indigenous communities, or comunidades indígenas, or pueblos indígenas, as a result of the legislation promoted by Las Casas in 1542, and then the various Spanish legislation that occurred throughout the Spanish hegemony in South America. These indigenous groups face serious problems of land scarcity. They're mainly agricultural populations rather than hunting or fishing or mixed subsistence economies. They're based on agriculture. They're usually connected to markets. Not only do they produce food to feed themselves and their families, but they also sell their products in markets. And when people speak of the poorest of the poor in South America or in Central America, the poorest people are the rural people who are still indigenous. And in the Andes, for example, in the Andes of Bolivia and in Ecuador and Peru, we find some of the poorest rural populations that have minuscule parcels of land, what are usually called the minifundia. And they're usually living in societies where they're the majority population ethnically and socially, but where the major control of land is in the hands of large latifundias, or plantations that are controlled by non-Indian agricultural entrepreneurs who own plantations, who basically produce for export markets, sugar or coffee or bananas or some other export product. So these indigenous communities are the majority population, but they have minority control of the land. The problem that they face today in gaining access to land has to do with agrarian reform programs. In Bolivia in 1952, in Ecuador in the 1960s and 70s, in Peru and in Colombia, there were major national programs of agrarian reform, which attempted to change the land tenure structure by getting rid of the latifundias that weren't productive, that weren't being used, and by distributing those through the state agrarian reform apparatuses and the legislative system of the country to indigenous and peasant communities. Bolivia is the most well-known example of that, but it also took place in Colombia and Peru and Ecuador. The Alliance for Progress in 1960 had an enormous effect in promoting these agrarian reform programs among Latin American countries. The problem that indigenous people face, and I think there may be some parallels here with Alaska, is that in setting up the basic institutional structure of agrarian reform, the main institution of agrarian reform came out of the urban areas rather than the rural areas of South America. The two main institutions were what is known as the Peasant League and the Rural Syndicate, the Liga de Campesino and the Sindicato Rural. The Peasant League and the Rural Syndicate. These two institutions came out of people who were involved in the urban labor movements, who wanted to generate participation of the rural peasantries in the national political system. They were mainly union organizers from cities that were connected with political parties that had nationalist or left-wing ideologies that were interested in politically mobilizing rural indigenous populations for the purpose of taking over the state through democratic processes. Although they were called revolutions, they weren't violent revolutions. They were basically electoral revolutions. In the case of Peru, they were led by a military government that then announced an agrarian reform. The problem with these is they're faced by indigenous communities today was the problem of that the Peasant League and the Rural Syndicate weren't indigenous institutions. Not only were they controlled by urban sectors, but the institutions themselves had to do with basically economic and political rather than cultural needs of the population. They had to do with access to the state power, and they had to do with increasing national production. They didn't have to do with the survival of indigenous communities. In fact, in many indigenous communities, enormous conflicts emerged between the peasant leagues and the rural syndicates and the traditional Indian leadership in these communities. In the 1960s and increasingly in the 70s, the indigenous leadership on the local level of indigenous communities found out that they weren't being represented by the national peasant federations and by the national rural unions. And they began to introduce rural indigenous federations rather than just peasant leagues that were connected with national political parties. They began to name their organizations after indigenous leaders like Tupac Amaru, who was the great Inca rebel and prophet in the 1700s, Tupac Amaru, and other indigenous leaders. They began to look at indigenous modes of political organization and of work and production and began to form national indigenous federations that were linked with local indigenous communities. Their most basic struggle was to reaffirm the juridic personality of the indigenous community before the state legislative system, and to ensure that in the process of agrarian reform, the indigenous community would continue to exist rather than being suppressed by the state agrarian bureaucracy or by the national peasant leagues. In other words, they made what in Latin America is an ethnic assertion in the midst of a national political process around the institution of the indigenous community. The national context there in the Andean countries is radically different than Alaska, but the struggle of indigenous communities against urban-imposed federations and rural syndicates may have some parallels with the struggle between Alaskan Native villages and corporations as an alien form of political imposition and economic imposition that may be similar. So that's a second area, very complex in terms of each one of those national countries and the evolution of in the history there in those areas. A third area that I'll point out, and I will only briefly mention it, although it's of enormous importance now, is in Central America. In Central America, which is the indigenous situation in Central America includes both highland indigenous groups that are similar to the Andean groups that are faced by problems of agrarian dispossession and landlessness, and groups that are searching for a place in national society in terms of agrarian social change, large majority populations. The most important of those are the Mayan Indians, especially of southern Mexico, of Guatemala, and of stretching into parts of El Salvador where there's other populations as well. These people number in the millions. In Guatemala alone, of a country of 7.5 million people, perhaps 4 million people, if not more, are Mayan speakers of one of 22 Mayan Indian languages. The Maya are the major indigenous presence in the highland areas, organized into hundreds of indigenous communities, similar to the Andean Indians of South America. The other aspect is, like in the lowlands of South America, in Central America, there's lowland indigenous populations that are much smaller in size and living in areas where they're struggling for subsistence in very delicate ecological area zones, lowland tropical zones, in the face of enormous threat from national development and colonization along the lowland frontiers. The two groups that are probably the most well-known are the Kuna Indians of Panama, the Kuna of Panama, that live both in island communities off the coast of Panama and on the maritime lowlands of Panama, that have maintained a degree of autonomy from the state through various accords and treaties with the Panamanian officials, and are probably the group in South America, and perhaps in all of the Americas, that today possesses more sovereignty in the true meaning of the term than perhaps any other indigenous group in the Americas right now, the Kuna of Panama, and also maintains a type of political organization and natural economy that's more related to their national system. The other example, which has been in the news, are the Miskito and the Sumo and the Rama of the eastern coast South America, of Nicaragua, the Miskito, Sumo, and Rama, that perhaps number about 120,000 people on the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua, that live in one of the most ecologically interesting areas in South America, because the rainforest comes right up to the ocean. And the people maintain an environmental adaptation which includes both maritime fishing and turtle hunting and the usage of inland rivers and inland animal resources, as well as horticulture for subsistence. This area, like other areas of lowland South America, the east coast of Nicaragua, has been faced from the late 19th century, but increasingly after the Second World War, by enormous penetration by outside timber companies, mining companies, and colonization, such that from about 1965 onward, the percentage of people on the Atlantic